From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We are denouncing war, whether it's war on Iraq or whether war on anywhere in the world. We have our basic mission and our call is that we must resolve all differences through peaceful negotiations.
From Pakistan to Italy to South Africa, a global conversation of people working for peace. Then, is the government detaining Iraqi Americans? The Department of Homeland Security has implemented a policy of detaining asylum seekers from 33 nations. This could result in hundreds of arrests. And hundreds of Pakistani immigrants are at the Canadian border in New York, Vermont, and Michigan as the March 21st registration deadline draws near. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In an effort to display a show of international support for the war, the Bush administration has listed 30 countries that have publicly backed a U.S. invasion of Iraq. Of these nations, only two, Britain and Australia, plan to supply troops. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said another 15 unnamed nations are part of the coalition of the willing. But the Washington Post reports some of the named nations were surprised by their inclusion. A senior diplomat at Colombia's embassy, for one, was unaware that his nation had been listed. The 30 governments, together with the United States, represent some 1.1 billion people, about a sixth of the total population of the world. And the list includes no governments in the Arab world. Texas Democrat Lloyd Doggett criticized the so-called coalition. He said, quote, "The posse announced today is mighty weak. It includes such military powerhouses as Eritrea and Estonia and pariahs like Uzbekistan with a human rights record as difficult to defend as Saddam Hussein's." The congressman added, quote, "This list is an embarrassing indication of the administration's foreign policy failure." The Guardian of London is reporting the United States will likely unleash a new high-powered microwave weapon, or E-bomb, in the opening hours of the assault on Iraq. The weapon fires a massive pulse of microwave energy and is designed to wipe out enemy weapon systems. The U.S. claims the weapons pose no harm to humans. USA Today is reporting that a small team of Delta forces armed with high-tech weapons and night vision goggles will soon descend on the outskirts of Baghdad in an attempt to capture and kill Saddam Hussein. In New York, Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix says he's disappointed that the inspections were not allowed to continue. He said, quote, "I don't think it's reasonable to close the door on inspections after 3.5 months. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia warned yesterday that the government has room to scale back individual rights during wartime without violating the Constitution. He said, "Most of the rights you enjoy go way beyond what the Constitution requires." And the Justice Department has announced it will indefinitely jail all new asylum seekers from 33 Arab and Muslim countries. The announcement came as the Department of Homeland Security unveiled Operation Liberty Shield as a response to possible threats. As for an attack on Iraq, the U.S. Pentagon is talking about its new name for the action, Operation Iraqi Freedom. The lower house of the Russian parliament yesterday delayed ratification of a nuclear arms control treaty with the United States because legislators accused the Bush administration of setting the stage for a world war. James Charles Kopp was convicted yesterday of methodically tracking, shooting, and killing Barnett Slepian, a New York gynecologist who performed abortions. He faces up to 25 years in prison. Kopp's attorney attempted to argue that killing a doctor who performs abortions is an act of defense to save unborn babies. Israeli forces fired tear gas and stun grenades yesterday in an attempt to break up a memorial service for Rachel Corrie, the American peace activist killed by an Israeli army bulldozer in Gaza on Sunday. This according to a report in The Guardian of London. The 23-year-old woman with the International Solidarity Movement was crushed to death Sunday while she tried to prevent the destruction of Palestinian homes by the Israelis in the Rafah town in Gaza. One witness said people were laying carnations at the spot where Rachel was killed when a tank came and fired tear gas at them. Tensions increased further when a convoy of vehicles, including the bulldozer that killed Corey, passed the area.
What had been for 11,000 years, ancient ice and snow, is melting like 11,000 tears down the face of Kilimanjaro,
where time itself is frozen, suspended in the air. Now the water flows on Kilimanjaro, damaging the essence of our atmosphere, threatens our existence, Kilimanjaro. Oh, Kilimanjaro.
You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It just got a mere mention on Larry King's show last night. He read this: dozens of Iraqis in at least five United States cities thought to be sympathetic to Saddam Hussein's regime will be detained because war is imminent. King went on to report the government sources told CNN the individuals could pose a danger to Americans or U.S. interests, sources said, but the sources would not be more specific about the nature of the danger. He read, these Iraqis have been under surveillance until now, and the Justice Department is heading the detention effort. We're going to start today's program with Anas Shalal. He is an Iraqi-American living in Washington, D.C., a partner for peace with the Seeds of Peace program and one of the founders of the Mesopotamia Cultural Society. Welcome to Democracy Now! Anas Shalal, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Have you heard about this?
Well, we've been hearing sort of some balloons floated about that issue in the past. We had, when Congressman Cobble of North Carolina mentioned internment as a possible option for the U.S. For its homeland security, it sort of sent chills up and down the Iraqi and Arab and Muslim community. And I think we're sort of hearing more and more of that sort of being floated, sort of almost bringing it out so people can sort of get used to it. And then when it happens, it's not so shocking.
It's interesting because we saw no other reference to this but this, couple sentence note that Larry King said he was handed during his program on another issue.
Well, the fear I think a lot of the Iraqi American community has here, and the Arab community and the Muslim community right now, is that this government has sort of lied and deceived itself into this war, and so with that idea and the fact that they're, even when the lies are shown right to their face, they're still not willing to sort of, back off and say, we made a mistake or whatever. They keep moving forward. They have a single trajectory, and they're not willing to veer from it in any way, shape, or form. Now, you put all that weight behind arresting people that have really limited resources, and you've got a very horrible situation that people won't be able to defend themselves.
Can you talk about what has happened to you or other Iraqi-Americans that you know recently?
Well, we feel the only way you can combat this kind of discrimination is to speak out. That if you stop speaking out, this is when they'll move in. So my mission is really to continue to speak out, speak truth to justice, and to keep encouraging people like you, Amy, to bring this up, because I think it's so important. A lot of things have sort of gone under the radar for us here. The Patriot Act, too, is sitting on the sidelines ready to be approved. And with that, some draconian measures are going to be taken to even limit our civil liberties even more, not just for Iraqi Americans, but for all Americans. This is obviously a very upsetting situation, because most of us that have moved to this country, moved to this country with the intent that this country has the freedom, the ability to speak out, the ability to move about, you know, freely. A lot of, especially Iraqi Americans, left Saddam Hussein's regime because of the very reasons that we are now facing here in this country.
What about the level of questioning? Have you been questioned, for example?
I have not, but I know of a couple of people that have. The questioning is very low grade, very non-intrusive, but it's still, for most people that get a knock on their door and somebody flashes a badge in your face, it does send chills up and down your spine. It's just not a very comfortable situation to be in, obviously. I think it's a form of intimidation. You know, it's a form of cultural violence. I mean, it's just a systematic and deliberate attempt to scare people.
What happened during the Persian Gulf War in 1990 and 1991?
Well, I think during the beginning in 1991 with the Persian Gulf War, most of us Iraqi Americans were really not in the fray that much. We sort of stayed quiet and laid low. I think there was a fear, and I think much of that fear was not really borne out. I think a lot of people felt after the Gulf War was over that things have sort of leveled off. But then in 1998, when there was another attempt to go and attack Iraq, a lot of us Iraqi Americans felt it's important for us to speak out and be able to sort of let our voices be heard. And now I think with this situation that's happening right now, after 9/11, you know, all rules have been thrown out the window, and now it's the rule of the jungle. It's whoever has the power, and in this situation, the government has the power, and they're able to do whatever they please if they decide to do it.
We're also joined on the phone by other immigrant rights activists. In other immigration news, hundreds of Pakistanis in the United States have headed to the Canadian border in recent weeks, swamping shelters, mosques, churches, and aid agencies along the border. Already this year, almost 1,700 Pakistanis have applied for refugee status at Canadian crossings. All of last year, there were only 2,200. The surge of people seeking safe haven is the latest result of Washington's new mandate that men from 25 mostly Muslim nations register their whereabouts with federal officials and be photographed, fingerprinted, and submit to questioning. The Canadian government says it's been unable to process the surge in claims, forcing Canadians to send hundreds of Pakistanis back across the border to await future appointments. Hundreds of Pakistanis are now stranded along the Canadian border with New York and Vermont. We're going to go first to Monami Maulik, who is founder and organizer of DRUM, Desi's Rising Up and Moving. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
We're also joined by Elizabeth Wokey, who is assistant director at Vive la Casa, an organization for world refugees in Buffalo. Welcome.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, can you tell us the scene on the border in Buffalo?
Right now we have about 800 people waiting to go to Canada, waiting for appointments at the Canadian border to start a refugee claim in Canada. A lot of those people are from registration countries, in particular Pakistan, but also Egypt, Bangladesh, and Indonesia. There are people waiting at our shelter, which has 118 beds and has been full for a couple of months. There are also people waiting in local hotels and people waiting throughout the country. But the wait times have risen from less than a week before this all started until about 6 weeks right now.
Where are people staying?
Well, we have about 80 Canadian-bound asylum seekers staying at our shelter in Buffalo. There are some... Most families who brought some resources with them are staying in cheap hotels in the local Buffalo area. A lot of people have been forced to go back to from wherever they came from to stay with family and friends while they wait for their appointments. There are also some other shelters who are trying to take people in, but no one is really equipped to do so in this area anyway.
Monami Maulik, you're letting people know in the New York area about what's happening on the border. Is this unprecedented?
At least in our community, we haven't faced
this sort of fear and this sort of a human rights situation. It's Pakistanis, but also Bangladeshis, and many of them are going from the New York City area because New York City has one of the largest concentrations of these communities. And I think a lot of these people, what's important to understand is that a lot of these people are people who cannot afford to be detained and deported because they're fleeing situations in their home countries, or they're seeking asylum. And so if they were to be deported, their lives would be at risk. And then there's also a broad category of people who cannot go back because they're what we call economic refugees. I mean, they were forced to come here in the first place because of U.S. policies, particularly in South Asia and Southeast Asia in the last 10 years, that have really devastated economies and lives. And so it's not a situation of a choice. I mean, people are fleeing with their families, and it's creating a humanitarian crisis.
Elizabeth Wolke, what actually is happening on the border? People go to the place where you cross over into Canada, the different entrance points to Canada?
Well, at the Buffalo border, our organization makes appointments for people to initiate the asylum process in Canada. At other points along the border, there are no organizations. So, for example, north of Plattsburgh at the Montreal border, people just go on their own, and that's where people have been sent back to the U.S., and a lot of men have been detained, and the women and children have been left there in the snow and that sort of situation. Luckily, at our border here in Buffalo, we're able to make appointments for people ahead of time, but since we've been seeing such an increase in numbers and Canadian immigration has not been correspondingly increasing the number of people that they take per day, that's where we're getting this backup and this humanitarian crisis, as Mon Ami calls it.
What do you think needs to be done right now for people along the border?
Well, I think that Canadian immigration needs to respond in some way to this crisis, which they haven't. We're getting in an average of 35 people a day into our center who wish to make a refugee claim in Canada. The Canadian government is only taking about 15 to 17 people a day. So every day we're getting another backup of about 20 people. That's one thing that we need, is pressure on the Canadian immigration, the Minister of Canadian Immigration, to put more resources on the border to deal with this crisis. The other thing is that all of the border organizations are in need of support and donations, funding from people, throughout the country.
Mon Ami Maulik, what does this mean for people who are not on the border? For example, those who will be going on Friday to immigration authorities to register. Again, we see that on Friday, just 2 days from now, Pakistani and Saudi Arabian immigrants have to register with immigration officials. If they don't register, they'll be imprisoned or deported. If they do register, many of them may also be imprisoned or deported. Then people from Bangladesh, Egypt, Indonesia, Jordan, and Kuwait must register by April 25th.
I think what's really frightening is that, as the first gentleman was speaking about, that I think a lot of these policies have been put into place for a while. And so with the INS, or now what's called BICE, the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the enforcement wing under the Homeland Security, what we're seeing is that clearly in the last few weeks to few months, there's been a move to increase the capacity of detention centers and beds. So in effect, what's happening is that locally in New Jersey, hundreds of new beds are being opened up. One way is through recent mass deportations. 120 Pakistanis were deported from Hudson County Jail about a week ago, and there's also reports of another deportation that happened after that. So that means that facility now is opening up about 200 beds. And similarly, there's a lot of shifting and changing happening in detention centers. Another new development is that the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement is looking to open up a brand new detention facility within a 200-mile radius of 26 Federal Plaza. And right now, they're soliciting contracts to open up such a facility. So I think there's a lot of things coming down the pike. And what we need to do right now more than ever is to put pressure
on this new Department of Homeland Security, the new administration that's overseeing immigration enforcement, and that's militarizing not only the borders, but local areas as well. I mean, we've seen in Jackson, in places like Jackson Heights, where our community offices and in other immigrant neighborhoods, a rapid step up of militarization. And there's, you know, federal agents, there's more policing, there's men with machine guns in the subways constantly harassing people who seem or are perceived as immigrants and asking for their immigration status.
And Elizabeth Wolke, on the border, we talked about people from Muslim and Arab countries.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an increase of immigrants from other countries?
Well, right now, yeah, we are actually seeing an increase of people from Colombia, Venezuela in particular, trying to get to the Canadian border as well. It's not connected to registration. It's just connected to the general anti-immigrant climate in the U.S. right now and people feeling that Canada is a safer option for them.
People from Colombia?
Uh-huh. We've always had a high number of people from Colombia. They're our number one country in the past year. Many of them have been in the U.S. for more than a year, so they're no longer eligible to apply for asylum in the U.S. But since the situation in Colombia continues to deteriorate, they're looking for protection, seeking asylum, and choosing Canada to do that.
Monami Malik, if someone isn't sure what to do, for example, about registering by Friday, if they're from Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or the upcoming deadline for immigrants from other countries, where should they call?
They can call our office at Drum. We speak a few different languages, and we can refer them to attorneys who can assist them as well and accompany them. Our number is 718-205-3036. I also believe that they can call ALDEF, which is the Asian American Legal Defense and Asian and Education Fund, at 212-966-5932. And today there actually is going to be a press conference held by about a dozen or so organizations in New York around this special registration at Federal Plaza at 11 a.m.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Monami Malik, founder and organizer of Drum, Desi's Rising Up and Moving, and Elizabeth Wolke, assistant director at Vive La Casa, an organization for world refugees in Buffalo. Before that, our guest was Nan Chalal, who is an Iraqi-American speaking to us from Washington, D.C. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Women in search of safety, children in need of food, struggling for our freedom, so I am a refugee. Women of hope and courage, living through poverty, fleeing from war and terror, so I am a refugee. Powerful and resilient, seeing my people through, sharing my truth and wisdom. So I am a refugee. I am a speaker. I am a dancer. I am a singer. And I am a refugee. By intuition, no longer a refugee. Women of strength and beauty, driven by faith and heart, moving our people forward.
Refugee, Pat Humphreys and Sandy Opitau here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. People around the world who helped to organize the massive protests of, well, roughly 30 million people around the world on February 15th saying no to war, say they are not through yet. And as Colin Powell announces that he has a coalition of 30 countries that have publicly backed a U.S. invasion, yet the Washington Post reports some of the countries named were surprised by their inclusion. We're going to have a conversation across continents about peace. We're joined on the line by Mohammed Tahseen, speaking to us from Lahore, Pakistan, who is executive director of the South Asia Partnership, Pakistan. Michael Sachs is with us from Johannesburg, head of policy and research with the African National Congress in South Africa. And Paula is with us, an organizer with an international coalition to stop the war, speaking to us from Genoa, Italy. Thank you very much to all of you for joining us. Paula, let's begin with you. What is happening now in Italy?
But first of all, let me greet all the American resistance against war. What's happening in Italy? Presently, right in this moment, is undergoing the discussion in the parliament, in the Senate, about Italy being in the list, not in being in the list, but essentially supporting the American war and British and the willing, being one of the willing countries. There is very little debate. It's been an imposition from our government, this war and this participation in Italy. So there is a resistance in the sense that presently the parliament is there is a drapel of people that is under every under the parliament and under every state building representing the parliament in each town, and we are waiting for the final resolution and eventually for a vote. And tonight there will be a vigil and probably there will be some civil disobedience. Definitely there will be some stopping. Our idea is to stop all the towns in Italy if the war starts, when the war starts, even more, if we are unwilling part of it. That will be done with pacific means, but we essentially plan to occupy most of the streets and try to have also the shops closed. In Italy, the coalition is big, has grown very big. We have churches and trade unions with us. The trade unions have 4 hours of strike as soon as the war starts. And so it's possible. It's possible that we have a complete arrest of the country if the war starts, the day the war starts. And then there is a long resistance plan already planned. Next Saturday, we will have the presence of the military installations in Italy in 4 different places. One is in Arbor and the other are the command of the Southern Mediterranean Forces in Naples and in Sigonella in Sicily, which is a NATO basis, and another NATO basis in Aviano, from where weapons and supplies have been shipped around to go to the Gulf. We had been doing train stopping throughout the period of the shipping that is sitting on the trucks and trying to stop the trains, which has been sort of successful, at least in delaying them. But, of course, civil disobedience, as you know, is not necessarily able to stop things with peaceful ways.
Michael Sachs on the line with us also from Johannesburg, head of policy and research with the African National Congress. Can you talk about the level of resistance in South Africa? When we hear about protests around the world, we don't hear very much from the African continent. That doesn't mean that the actions aren't taking place, perhaps that the media just isn't paying attention.
Yeah, I think perhaps on the level of the numbers of people out on the streets, it's perhaps not as high as those countries where governments are, especially those countries where governments are supporting the war effort. I think what has happened here, though, is that the new international situation has created an unprecedented unity of political forces across the spectrum. Indeed, since the days of the anti-apartheid struggle, I don't think we've seen such a great unity of the entire society around a single issue. On the 15th of February, we joined the rest of the world, and I would estimate between 50 and 100,000 people were on the streets of various cities throughout the country. Also on the 19th, about 10,000 people did march to the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria. As it's become increasingly clear that the U.S. intends to proceed with their unilateral action, we on this side, knowing that our government has really taken a principled position against the war, and clearly the entire spectrum of our people have also taken a principled position against the war, our thoughts are turning now to the innocent victims of this aggression in Iraq. Yesterday there was a prayer service outside the U.S. consulate in Johannesburg, where a range of political organizations and religious faiths gathered with candles to pray, especially for the women and children in Iraq. Similar activities are going to be taking place throughout the country at all U.S. Consulates. Also, once the bombing actually starts, we do expect to see continuous pickets outside the U.S. consulates and embassies. Furthermore, the trade union movement has been acting to conscientize the working class and work with their people, particularly at the ports, to try and ensure that South African ports are not used by the belligerent countries as part of their war preparations. And several civil society groups are beginning to call for a boycott of U.S. products as a contribution to the campaign against the war. So really, I think at this stage we're in a situation where from a protest which united the entire country, we're now turning towards a prayer for the people of Iraq.
One of the countries that General Colin Powell, Secretary Colin Powell, has cited as part of the coalition of the willing is Eritrea. Also, Djibouti is a place of mass U.S. military preparation.
I think that probably it would be better to describe the American coalition as a coalition of the unwilling. We know that in the African continent in particular, the U.S. administration has the capacity to bring enormous financial and, to an extent, military pressure to bear on poor African countries that are burdened with a huge debt. And it's not surprising that some of the two countries that you mentioned are both very small countries, very underdeveloped countries. And quite frankly, it's not surprising to me that they've agreed to participate in this coalition of the unwilling. But I think the vast majority of African countries, in fact, the African Union, the regional organization, has taken a resolution where it resolutely states its opposition to the war. The African members of the Security Council, I think, were clear in their opposition to the war. And I don't think there's, aside from the American threats and financial inducements that are going around the place, I don't think there's really any support whatsoever on the continent of Africa for this war.
It is very interesting that Angola, Guinea, and Cameroon, the three UN Security Council African countries, despite being spied on, that information that came out of the leaked NSA document, that there would be a surge on spying on home and office emails and all communications of these diplomats at the United Nations, and given their financial situation, that they did not cave and seemed to stand firm right up until the Bush administration pulled that second resolution.
Yeah, I think that for us, the worry becomes one that if a government as powerful as the American state, the most powerful state in history, is able to act to change regimes around the world, once they've finished with the Middle East, we hope that the rest of us will be safe from such actions. We know that, for example, Angola has one of the recently huge oil deposits have been discovered in Angola. And definitely the pressure that the U.S. administration is able to bring to bear on such countries is enormous.
We're also joined on the telephone by Mohamed Tassin, who is executive director with the South Asia Partnership Pakistan, an NGO in Lahore, which is coordinating a secular anti-war movement in the region. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about what is happening in your area, in Lahore?
Well, a couple of things in terms of what's happening and for the last 2 weeks, what one is witnessing in almost all major cities of Pakistan, there are almost daily processes, peace protests and marches going along, candlelight dinner, you know, candlelight vigils, et cetera, et cetera. There is another part to it, and that is the religious fundamentalists also talking about against the war on Iraq. The distinction between these two kinds of peace movements is that the organizations and people like us who are demonstrating in various cities, we're talking about peace and resolutions of conflicts through peaceful negotiations. However, the fundamentalists are talking against war on Iraq. However, unfortunately, they are not sticking to the peace as a value. Like they're saying, it's good to attack Kashmir or India or Israel or America. So it's that kind of a distinction which is coming about. Fortunately, people like us or the large majority of people were pretty quiet on the issue of war on Iraq. However, there was a very strong resentment all over the country, I can safely say, against the U.S. policies in Pakistan and the rest of the world. And in the last couple of weeks, one has found people getting together in various formations and raising their protest against any war on Iraq or anywhere in the world. So this is the general kind of a scene. Every day in every city, you find different groups getting together and protesting against the war on Iraq. The major issue which one is grappling with in Pakistan is that the whole debate started when President George Bush said this is going to be a crusade. And suddenly the whole religious right in Pakistan started saying, look, this is a war against Muslims. But now the situation, and especially my greetings and my best tribute to friends in America as well as peace lovers in Europe, whether they were, you know, whatever religion they followed, they came out. And we found in Pakistan a lot more space and acceptability of bringing out this agenda that this is not a war on or against Muslims or Islam per se, but this is a war on anyone who is talking against the new classical, new liberal economic agenda of the U.S. and its allies. So this has come about, which is, again, I think, has given us a different kind of a space, and people are joining in. What we are doing at the moment, we are protesting all over the countries in various cities and in some villages also. And on the 20th, like yesterday, I'm here in Peshawar in NWFP at the moment. Yesterday, our friends in Peshawar, the Joint Action Committee, they had not only a big protest meeting, but also a rally in Peshawar, which I think is the first rally which really attracted people from various political walks of life, political parties, media people, trade unions. I mean, representatives came in, plus NGOs and civil society organizations, and received a kind of a warm welcome. People were really charged against U.S., but on the issue of attack on Iraq, but the general situation, as one read and heard from friends today, was that, yes, less talk of peace and less talk of global peace. Having said that, on the 20th, we are bringing out a big, large, hopefully very large protest rally in Lahore, basically, again, advancing the agenda of secular and liberal position in Pakistan, and that is that less talk, raise our voice against the U.S. imperialism and such new liberal economic agenda of the world which they're trying to put in. The position of our government is confused. I mean, our government is unwillingly taking side, if not openly, but tacitly taking side with the U.S. I mean, we were hearing that if at all the second resolution goes for war, the government of Pakistan would abstain, which is great. But generally, you know, I can safely say more than 80% of the population of Pakistan is against the U.S. policies in the region, and especially against the attack on Iraq. What we are thinking is that, right after the bombing of Iraq, there is a talk that we should immediately give a call of boycotting the U.S. goods as well as all other goods from the Britain, especially. There are trade unions who have joined in. There is a demand that there are three military establishments which are given to U.S. People here, not for this war, but you know, for other purposes on war against on Afghanistan. We are demanding that the government should immediately ask Americans to vacate these places, and these should not be used. There is also a lot of discussion in these protests and public rallies also, protest meetings and rallies, that, you know, it's very unethical asking Saddam to resign. I personally don't find any reason of defending Saddam, what he has done to the world and especially to Iraqi people. However, if at all taking on that light, what we are saying, okay, if you're asking for the resignation of Saddam, why don't you talk of impeaching Tony Blair and Bush in their own countries? And why not talking of, you know, asking for the resignation of Indian government as well as the government of Pakistan, which are two atomic powers? Unfortunately, the situation between India and Pakistan in terms of diplomacy and diplomatic things, it speaks volumes for itself, because it's at the lowest ebb at the moment, and anything can happen. Maybe under the garb of Iraq war, you never know that both of these governments start saying, I mean, we are atomic powers, and unfortunately, they may start a war, and I don't rule that out. So let's, if at all you're talking of that, of the world peace, and you're talking of resignations of one dictator another, then it is high time we should, if at all, we should seek the impeachment of two, you know, Prime Minister Britain, the President of America, Government of Pakistan should resign, the BJP from India should resign. So it's that kind of a discussion.
Mohammad Taseem, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll be joined by George Monbiot, a columnist with The Guardian in Britain, to continue this global conversation. Mohammad Taseem, Executive Director with the South Asia Partnership in Pakistan. Before that, Michael Sachs with the ANC in Johannesburg. Paula, speaking to us from Geneva, Italy, with the International National Coalition to Stop the War. You're listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, back in a minute. We shall not be moved. Sweet Honey in the Rock here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. The clock runs out on the Bush ultimatum at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time tonight, after which George Bush says that the U.S. can invade Iraq. The news out of Britain last night, Tony Blair, the prime minister, won a Commons mandate for the coming war with Iraq after a day of fierce debate in the House of Commons. the rebellion of 139 Labour members of parliament was a record revolt. George Mambia with us. He is a columnist with the Guardian newspaper in Britain. What do you make of what your prime minister is doing now?
Well, he's clearly very much at odds with the will of most people in the country. And had there been a free vote, it would have been obvious that he was at odds with the great majority of MPs as well. What happened in the past few days was a very concerted effort on the part of the parliamentary enforcers, the people we call the whips, to persuade MPs to vote the way the Prime Minister wanted them to vote. And their methods of persuasion involved threats of all kinds. You won't ever become a minister. You will lose your special privileges. We will expose your private life to the tabloid newspapers, and various bribes of we might consider you for promotion if you vote with the Prime Minister. So it's a bit like, in a way, what the US and British governments were doing to the temporary members of the Security Council, a lot of bribery and blackmail and intimidation. And had that not been deployed, we would have seen a very clear Commons vote against going to war with Iraq, because MPs up and down the country in Britain are very aware that their constituents are extremely upset about what's happening.
Britain is sending a 45,000-strong military force to surround Iraq right now.
Yes, that's right. This force is going to be supplementing the forces of the United States, and effectively under the command of the United States. And people in Britain find their loyalties split. On the one hand, we are very concerned about what might happen to our soldiers out there, and we wish them well, and we give them all our support and the hope that they'll come back alive. On the other hand, we think they're fighting the wrong war.
We were just speaking with Michael Sachs, who is with the ANC in Johannesburg, part of Stop the War Coalition there. You have just done a piece in The Guardian talking about a humanitarian disaster engulfing Africa as cash is poured into the war with Iraq and its aftermath. Would you care to elaborate?
Yes, that's right. I mean, what we've seen happening is not just a huge transfer of funds in the US and the UK into military spending, but we've also seen a great transfer of humanitarian funding, a potential transfer to Iraq and away from the rest of the world. And the big donor nations have all been sitting on their hands, waiting to see what happens with Iraq, waiting to see how much money they have to pour into Iraq in the aftermath of this war. And so they haven't been funding countries anywhere else. And the result is a complete humanitarian catastrophe. We could have the worst funding shortfall for humanitarian aid around the world at any time since the Second World War. There seems to me to be a massive contradiction between what George Bush and Tony Blair say they want to do in Iraq. They want to help people to throw off their dictator and have a better life, and what they're actually doing as far as helping people to have a better life in the rest of the world is concerned. There are now many, many instances where entire populations of refugees, of people living in a particular region of a country, are now in very grave danger of starvation, and the international community is doing nothing whatsoever about it.
Your book, Captive State, where you talk about your democratic rights under threat, corporations becoming so powerful they now threaten the foundations of democratic government. How would you say that this perspective that you have feeds the war or fuels an invasion of Iraq?
Well, there's no question that there's a complex mixture of motives for this war, and few of them, I think, are creditable motives. Most of them are to do with geopolitical and regional control. And one of the things which the U.S. government wants to control is the resources of that region, not just oil, but of course oil is a critical one. This isn't just so that it gets those resources for U.S. corporations, though. The important thing to recognize is the big strategic picture, and a lot of this is about China. It's about making sure that the U.S. has effectively got its hand on the oil tap so that it can contain the growing economic power of China. And it's already done this very successfully in Central Asia. During the war with Afghanistan, it set up what it said were temporary military camps in all the Central Asian nations. There are now 13 of these camps, major U.S. camps. But even before the war was over, it said, we're not going to take these camps away once the war's over. It's built them up. They're continuing to build up. They're getting bigger despite the end of the war in Afghanistan. And it's very clear that they are effectively being used to control the region. And one of the outcomes of that is that the oil and gas in the region will be flowing westwards, not eastwards to China or northwards to Russia. Now, a very similar thing is happening in the Middle East at the moment. The U.S. already has complete strategic control of the Strait of Hormuz. It's by setting up a new base in Djibouti, it's going to get complete strategic control of the Bab al-Mandab. These are the two major shipping lanes for oil in the world through which China is supplied. And the Chinese are already getting extremely worried by this. And they see, I think quite rightly, what's going on in Iraq as very much a means of blocking off their fossil fuel supplies so that they can only get them in future at the behest of the United States, which then greatly contains the potential economic power of China as a possible rival to the U.S. on the world stage.
Well, George Monbiot, I want to thank you very much for being with us. George Monbiot is columnist with The Guardian in Britain. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move from Italy to South Africa, Pakistan to Britain, we're going to end with your voices, with voices of listeners and viewers around the country, as people continue to call in responding to an invasion, or still, we mustn't say it's inevitable before it happens.
You've reached Democracy Now! Please leave your name, where you're calling from, the station you listen to, and what you're doing in this time of impending war. Thanks for listening.
Yes, my name is Holly Arafat, and I'm calling from Silver City, New Mexico. We watch you on Free Speech TV, and we're so grateful. Right now we're praying for George Bush, that he will see the real difference between good and evil. We're also praying for our children, Iraqi children and our own children, that they will be able to live to be adults. It's a very scary time, and I'm just begging the American people to get off their couch and out from in front of CNN and go to the library and research what has really gone on.
Hi, my name is Lawrence Abbott. I'm from San Leandro, California. I listen to KPFA radio in the Bay Area. Cesar Chavez once said that the one thing they can't control is the American consumer. And what I'm doing is I'm boycotting pretty much everything. It's probably the most painful thing that a consumer society can do, but it's also the most powerful. Whenever you shop, think real hard before you pay what that dollar is going to create in the world. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
This is Holly Gwynn Gray. I'm calling from Olympia, Washington. We had a candlelight vigil as part of the Stop the War effort, and also to honor our young Rachel Corey, who died in Palestine. There were hundreds of people. Candles were lit. Pictures were shown. And we sang as a community. It was a very powerful evening, and we were all reaffirming our stand for peace in the world and for justice, things that Rachel stood for in our own peace community here in Olympia. I wrote a song for her. Farewell, farewell, Rachel Corey. Your story will not end. Though some might call you martyr, to us you were a friend. When first I saw Rachel Corey, she was standing up for peace. She was working hard for justice and for humankind's release. When last I saw Rachel Corey, she was crying out in vain, trying to stop the dozer that crushed her again and again. They say of Rachel Corey, her last act was so brave, but she stumbled and fell and they killed her and sent her to her grave. Do you hear the people singing? Do you hear their righteous sound? There'll be no more aid to Israel and no mowing people down. Rise up, all you people, and join your hearts in peace. Help justice come to Palestine. Demand that war to cease. Farewell, farewell, Rachel Corey. Your story will not end. There are some who call you martyr, but we knew you as friend.
Yeah, my name is Robert Okoff, and what am I doing? I'm rallying with everybody to back the President of the United States, and as well as to be alongside of our men and women of the forces for Britain and the United States, and as well as all the other countries that's along with us, especially at this time of need. And so should everyone else. Thank you.
Yes, hi. This is Jeanette Martinez. We listen to WJFF up here in the Catskills. Well, I'm part of the Sullivan Peace Group out here, and I'm also a singer-songwriter. As an artist, I feel frustrated because I really don't know how else to express my anxiety and my deep, deep anguish over what our government is doing, and so therefore I feel that my outlet is my art.
Yeah, hi, my name is Edgar Harris. I'm calling from Petaluma, California, and what I'm going to do when the war starts is fly some black flags on my car, big as I can, perhaps even a black wreath on my hood.
Hi, my name is Laura Rosa. I'm listening to you on 88.5 in Tampa, Florida, WMNF. And I'm going to be praying for everybody, especially for the people who are going to be doing acts of civil disobedience. I don't believe that's the way to help the crisis. We have to come together as a country, and we have to pray that we can see the view of other people without having civil disobedience. I pray that our leaders could see that also. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Some of the comments of our listeners and viewers around the country, and we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 212-209-2999. What are you doing in this time of war? That's 212-209-2999. Our website is www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. And our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Mother, mother, there's too many of you to cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This war is unequivocally illegal according to the UN Charter and fundamental principles of international law. It marks a return to the doctrine of preventive war that was outlawed at the Nuremberg Tribunal of 1946 as the supreme international crime.
according to international law, is an invasion of Iraq illegal? We will have a debate. Then we'll talk about direct actions in Australia, Spain, Scotland, Turkey, Italy, and other places. And finally, if the media in this country were state media, how would it be different?
In a study of all sources quoted in Iraq stories on four nightly network news programs during a two-week period in February, we found an overwhelming reliance on official sources. Skeptics, those who were merely unconvinced of the case for war or wanted more time for diplomacy or inspections to work, were grossly underrepresented. Sources identified as peace activists were nearly non-existent, just three sources out of 393, less than 1% of all those quoted. If broad debate and independent information are the oxygen of democracy, these networks failed the public at a crucial time.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. and British forces have moved into the demilitarized zone straddling the Iraq-Kuwait border in preparation for an attack on Iraq. Reuters is reporting convoys of U.S. and British tanks and fighting vehicles have been snaking through sandstorms in the Kuwaiti desert heading towards the Iraqi border. One Iraqi has already been shot dead off the coast of Kuwait. Less than 12 hours remain before the U.S. ultimatum to the Iraqi president Saddam Hussein to flee reaches its deadline at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tonight. Baghdad has rejected it. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has proposed for the first time that President Saddam Hussein should go into exile as a last-ditch bid to avert war. The Turkish government is asking its parliament to allow the U.S. military the right to use Turkey's airspace and air bases, but not to deploy ground troops. 2 weeks ago, the Turkish parliament rejected a request for the U.S. to deploy troops there. But since then, the nation's financial markets have plunged and the U.S. has rescinded a $6 billion aid package. In an effort to display a show of international support for the war, the Bush administration yesterday listed 30 countries that have publicly backed a U.S. invasion. Of these nations, only two, Britain and Australia, plan to supply troops. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said another 15 unnamed nations are part of the coalition of the willing. But the Washington Post reports some of the named nations were surprised by their inclusion. A senior diplomat at Colombia's embassy, for one, was unaware that his nation had been listed. The 30 governments, together with the United States, represent some 1.1 billion people, about one-sixth of the total population of the world. And the list includes no governments in the Arab world. Texas Democrat Lloyd Doggett criticized the so-called coalition. He said, "The posse announced today is mighty weak. It includes such military powerhouses as Eritrea and Estonia, and pariahs like Uzbekistan, where the human rights record is difficult to defend as Saddam Hussein's." The Texas congressman added, quote, "This list is an embarrassing indication of the administration's foreign policy failure." The Guardian of London is reporting the United States will likely unleash a new high-powered microwave weapon or E-bomb in the opening hours of the assault on Iraq. The weapon fires a massive pulse of microwave energy. It's designed to wipe out enemy weapons and communication systems. USA Today is reporting a small team of Delta forces armed with high-tech weapons and night vision goggles will soon descend on the outskirts of Baghdad in an attempt to capture and kill Saddam Hussein. In New York, Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix said he was disappointed that the inspections in Iraq were not allowed to continue. He said, "I don't think it's reasonable to close the door on inspections after 3.5 months. And the Justice Department has announced it will indefinitely jail all new asylum seekers from 33 Arab and Muslim countries. The announcement came as the Department of Homeland Security unveiled Operation Liberty Shield as a response to possible threats. Amnesty International quickly condemned the government's new asylum regulations. Executive Director William Schultz said, "Operation Liberty Shield denies liberty to the victims of human rights abuse who come to our country seeking freedom. Liberty from unwarranted detention is a hallmark of a free society. To name an operation that denies liberty to asylum seekers, Liberty Shield, is Orwellian. The name the Pentagon is giving to an invasion of Iraq is Operation Iraqi Freedom. Meanwhile, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia warned yesterday the government has room to scale back individual rights during wartime without violating the Constitution. He said, most of the rights you enjoy go way beyond what the Constitution requires. Vote to impeach. That's the headline to a full-page advertisement that appears in today's New York Times calling for the impeachment of President Bush. The ad reads in part, take back the Constitution, join the movement of deeply concerned people all across the U.S. who are voting to impeach. In another full-page ad that appears today, 150 writers sign an open letter to President Bush charging that there is, quote, no sufficient moral or historical justification for a preemptive war. James Charles Kopp was convicted yesterday of methodically tracking, shooting, and killing Barnett Slepian, a New York gynecologist who performed abortions. Kopp faces up to 25 years in prison. His attorney attempted to argue that killing a doctor who performs abortions is an act of defense to save unborn babies. Israeli forces fired tear gas and stun grenades yesterday in an attempt to break up a memorial service for Rachel Khoury, the U.S. peace activist killed by an Israeli army bulldozer in Gaza on Sunday. This according to a report in The Guardian of London. The 23-year-old member of the International Solidarity Movement was crushed to death Sunday while she tried to prevent the destruction of Palestinian homes by the Israeli military in the Gaza town of Rafah. One witness said people were laying carnations at the spot where Rachel was killed when a tank came and fired tear gas at them. Tensions increased further when a convoy of vehicles, including the bulldozer that killed Rachel, passed the area. Stop the War, Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. War against Iraq is, quote, unequivocally illegal under the UN Charter and international law generally. That's the conclusion of a new report by the Center for Economic and Social Rights. Meanwhile, other international law experts say the United States is well within its legal right to attack Iraq. This in part because Iraq has failed to abide by the ceasefire agreement that ended the first Persian Gulf War, they say. Today, we're going to have a debate on the legality of a U.S. attack against Iraq. We're joined from Geneva by Ruth Wedgwood, who's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international law at Johns Hopkins University. We're joined in our studio by Roger Norman, executive director of the Center for Economic and Social Rights. He just recently returned from Iraq. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Roger Norman, your report has just come out. Why don't you lay out your argument?
Well, what the report does is it first puts out the entire framework of international law that governs the resort to force, which is a very well-developed legal framework, in particular since World War II, because after World War II, the entire international community came together to establish the United Nations specifically to avoid the scourge of war. The quote is, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to humanity. And so from there, you have two exceptions only. They're very narrow exceptions. And it's, in my opinion, beyond dispute, beyond legal dispute, that the United States has violated this. And those who argue that 12-year-old Security Council resolutions give authorization today are ignoring the fact that the Security Council itself has spoken on this issue. The Security Council itself has remained seized of the issue, legally means they're responsible, and has said any authorization for force comes through the Security Council. Again, which is why you had this whole debate recently about a second Security Council resolution, which was rejected. And for the U.S. and U.K. to still justify, based on the on a Security Council refusal to approve war and circumvent that from a resolution 12 years ago, is legally indefensible, and I would say morally indefensible.
Ruth Wedgwood, your response.
Well, resolutions of the Security Council don't expire at the end of a year or 2 years or with any particular Secretary General. They are good law. And in 1991, at the conclusion of the Gulf War, as a condition of the ceasefire, the Security Council laid down what is really basically a constitutional framework for post-Gulf War Iraq. And at the center of it was the condition that Saddam had to agree on a continuing basis to disarm himself of all weapons of mass destruction. And frankly, at the time, this was seen as much of a triumph as from the left as from the right, because it was seen as a proof that you didn't have to have a war that took the fight to Baghdad. You didn't have to have unconditional surrender in order to have effective disarmament. You could rely on Iraq's promise. But that was a condition of a ceasefire, and when the condition is flagrantly and persistently violated, in every real sense, the ceasefire itself is no longer binding. In addition, even if you are a person who, like Nino Scalia, who prefers plain text, there's the accompanying Resolution 678 from November of 1990, and that said that members of the UN were authorized to use force both to eject Iraq from Kuwait and to enforce all, and here's the quotation, all, quote, subsequent relevant resolutions, unquote, to restore regional peace and security. So it's an authorization for the use of force looking forward to 687. So we have belt and suspenders. In addition, we've relied on these resolutions in both 1993 and 1998 when we used force to try to persuade Saddam to allow the inspectors to do their work efficiently. The French flew with us on that same basis in 93. The Brits flew with us in 98 and 93. Also, I just would, I guess, warn some people who are inclined to read the charter as if it was, again, the 1787 Constitution. There is a customary practice that has evolved with the UN Charter. And on any number of occasions, people have resorted with accepted community legitimacy to other ways of authorizing force, whether it was the decision by Secretary of State Dean Acheson in 1950 to go to the General Assembly to get a Uniting for Peace resolution for the Korean War when Russia was going to veto in the Council, or the practice in West Africa most recently where Nigeria and Ghana, under the aegis of the Economic Community of West African States, went in to do peacekeeping, peace enforcement in Liberia and Sierra Leone without prior council authorization. There really is, in a number of instances, Cuban Missile Crisis, others, resort to regional organizations as an alternative source of legitimacy, even though the charter itself doesn't openly give that permission.
Roger Norman, your response to Ruth Wedgwood.
Well, I think with Professor Wedgwood, we're unfortunately hearing why lawyers have a reputation of being able to take even plain language and twist it for its opposite meaning. Citing the war resolution 687, the authorization to force, it's well known, was terminated by the ceasefire resolution. That's what happens to force when you have a ceasefire, which is 687. Now, to argue that failure, material breach of 687 gives individual states the unilateral right to attack when and where they want is ludicrous. It's without precedent. And let me just read a quote from Professor Thomas Frank at NYU Law School, who's one of the world's leading authorities on the resort to force. He says, after all these actions, and now he's talking about the enormous number of UN resolutions that the Security Council passed showing that it is the master of this issue. After all these actions, to now state that the United Nations has not, in fact, occupied the field, that there remains under Article 51, which is the self-defense exception in the Charter, or under Resolution 678, the original force resolution, total freedom on the part of any UN member to use military force against Iraq at any point that any member considers there to have been a violation of the conditions set forth in Resolution 687, exactly the argument Professor Wedgwood makes, is to make a complete mockery of the entire system. And let me take that one step further to, I guess, highlight the mockery. Resolution 1441 was passed unanimously, 15-0. Why? Why did Syria, for example, whose position is well known, why did Russia, France, and China, who explicitly signed a written proviso to 1441 saying it does not authorize individuals, why would they have passed this resolution specifically? Because it did not authorize force by individuals. It said it has to go back to the Security Council. And let me actually give the specific provisions. I'm not sure how one can misinterpret these. At the end of 1441, it says that UNMOVIC, Hans Blix, if there is a material breach, it was specifically given to UNMOVIC to decide. If so, it would be reported to the Security Council. It says, and then under point 11, it directs UNMOVIC to report immediately to the Council in the event of this breach. And then 12, the Council decides to convene immediately upon receipt of such report to decide what to do. That's a second resolution. It's clear. And that second resolution didn't happen. It makes no sense to argue this is a lawful war. It clearly is not lawful.
Professor Wedgwood, the written proviso that they would need a second resolution, and that resolution was not approved by the Security Council. Your response?
All that 1441 says is that it itself gives no automaticity. There's nothing in it that purports to repeal 687 or 678. Now, I don't know how your other guest feels about Kosovo, but much of Europe thinks that Kosovo was legitimate. Much of America does, too.
What about the written, but just sticking to that point of the written provision by these countries saying that they would need a second resolution?
Well, that's France's view. That's France's current view. That's France's Russia's current view. Those criticisms from France and Russia would carry more weight with people, I think, if Russia and France had not been in the mid-90s actively undermining and deriding and obstructing much of UNSCOM's activities. When Rolf Ikeas, when Richard Butler went to the Council to try to make the inspection regime work, the Russian perm rep and the French perm rep were his most severe critics, saying that they were too intrusive, they were violating Saddam's privacy, the palaces were off limits. It's very hard to attribute good faith in regard to the inspection regime to two countries that didn't really want to make them work. I know Tom Frank. I like Tom Frank. We have some different views. International lawyers do differ in their views. But what many, many international lawyers have come to suppose is that whether it's Anne-Marie Slaughter at Princeton or Christian Thomaschatz in Humboldt in Germany, that there are times, particularly, say, in Kosovo, when procedural perfectionism or procedural literalism, the very things that most of your listeners would deride in Nina Scalia on the Supreme Court, a kind of literal reading, does not give sufficient scope to the purposes of the UN Charter, one of which is the realization of human rights, another of which is the protection of innocent civilians against the kind of depredations that come from weapons of mass destruction.
Roger Norman.
But in Kosovo, people saw a...
If I could respond, I mean, I think what we're hearing is a lot of irrelevant examples that avoid once again looking at the central issue in front of us, Kosovo, for example, being something that we could talk about, but really it does not have direct relevance. I want to give you another quote. This is from the Secretary General of the United Nations. He said, "The United Nations, founded to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, has a duty to search until the very end for peaceful resolution of conflicts. If the U.S. and others were to go outside of the Council and take military action, it would not be in conformity with the Charter." Kofi Annan is not a radical. He's very much under pressure in his position to not take views that aren't 100% supported. So he says it's illegal under the U.N. Charter. Professor Wedgwood cites three law professors who have gone on record justifying, giving public intellectual justification to something that's this clearly illegal. She doesn't mention that there are thousands upon thousands of international lawyers in an unprecedented historical moment, actually, sending letters to heads of state saying this is illegal. Legal associations. I mean, there's an overwhelming consensus. There's a certain point at which we have to deal with what is legal and what is not. And when you have an overwhelming consensus based on the clear text, the opinion of a few international jurists really, I think, should not mean very much.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want to ask a final question. That is, what does international law matter? I mean, is there any way to enforce it anyway? Is this just an intellectual discussion? Roger Norman is with us. His report has just come out. He argues that war is illegal. His report is called Tearing Up the Rules, the Illegality of Invading Iraq. He's with the Center for Economic and Social Rights. And Ruth Wedgwood is on the phone with us, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Back in a minute.
Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, all on board. Do I see Lieutenant Callie? Do I see Captain Medina? Do I see General Custer and all his crew? Do I see President Nixon, Henry Kissinger and the Congress? Do I see the voters, me and you? Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg.
Last train to Nuremberg, Pete Seeger's song sung by the Joel Raphael Band. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. In a minute, we're going to travel around the world to hear about direct actions from Australia to Italy to Scotland. But first, this last question to our guests, Roger Norman, Executive Director of the Center for Economic and Social Rights, and Ruth Wedgwood, international law professor at both Johns Hopkins and Yale University, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. What does international law matter anyway, Professor Wedgwood?
Let me, Amy, just to first clarify something. I was mentioning Christian Tomaschott in regard to Kosovo, not to Iraq. Well, international law matters because, in fact, the perception of legitimacy, the fact of legitimacy, is important. But I think if you know people around the UN, the lesson from that they took from the 90s, it's a lesson for the left, it's a lesson for the right, is that much of the worst things, many of the worst things that happened, Kosovo, in Rwanda, in Bosnia, came from the unwillingness of the UN community to use force to protect people in a timely way. The 300 resolutions on Bosnia, not till NATO went in 95, was the war finally terminated. UNPRO 4 used to go around delivering food and letting people get ethnically cleansed. Rwanda, the UN didn't go in, the U.S. didn't go in. And I think there's a sense of shame in the UN community for failure to use force to protect people. So if you're looking at the legitimacy that underlies the law, to focus on one snippet of this or that as if it was a household totem, without looking at the purposes of the UN Charter, I think is an archaic way of doing law.
Roger Norman, finally.
Well, I'm glad it was raised, the purposes of the UN Charter, because I did read from Kofi Annan before, but the central purpose of the UN Charter, its central purpose was to avert the scourge of war. Again, we can't be too Orwellian here to cite the purpose of the United Nations to justify war in contradiction to the United Nations. Now, why does law matter? Well, that's why it matters, because of its purposes. When war is a catastrophe, people die, blood is shed, children die. We all know this. We all know that war is a bad thing. And what we did after World War II is create a legal framework that was not detached from our morality. This is a terrible and dangerous argument that we're hearing now, Anne-Marie Slaughter in the New York Times, detaching law from morality. The laws meant to protect all of us. The UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Geneva Conventions, the Nuremberg Tribunals, they have a purpose which is a real-life purpose to save us from ourselves sometimes, to not ever allow any tyrants ever again to tear up the laws.
Does it have any teeth?
Well, what we're seeing is in some ways, no. And that is simply because if the most powerful country in the world decides, as the U.S. has decided, to tear up the UN Charter, as we say in our report, then it becomes the responsibility of the rest of us to defend international law. And I think the Security Council did try, and even the Secretary General at a level did try, and the United States, unfortunately, our government is in the position of defying the world because we can, militarily. And by the way, this is a revolution. This is a new American revolution, I feel, that we're facing, which is not my own opinion. You read what the Pentagon says in its official papers. You read what the people right now in the White House and Pentagon have been saying for 10 years. It's the unrestrained projection of American military power around the world. It requires shredding international law, because international law doesn't allow this kind of aggressive war. And I think we can give international law teeth. The movement that you see around the world can do that.
Roger Norman, Executive Director of the Center for Economic and Social Rights. The report from CESR is Tearing Up the Rules, the Illegality of Invading Iraq. Ruth Wedgwood, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, International Law Professor at Johns Hopkins and Yale University. And we are going to turn now to From Law to Direct Actions. This morning in Australia, Greenpeace activists dressed as United Nations peacekeepers and blockaded Prime Minister John Howard's official residence in Canberra. The protesters wore blue berets and chained themselves under four-wheel drive vehicles, blocking the gates of Howard's home. The Prime Minister was forced to leave by the back door. The action follows the Australian government's decision yesterday to commit Australian troops to an invasion of Iraq. In Turkey today, massive protests are planned at leading party headquarters as the Turkish government heads to a vote on whether the U.S. can use its airspace to wage war in Iraq. On Friday, some two dozen Greenpeace activists chained themselves to the wheels of a truck blocking an entrance to an eastern Turkish port where U.S. forces are unloading equipment. With dozens of Turkish soldiers with assault rifles manning the entrance, police dragged away the demonstrators from Turkey, Britain, Australia, Belgium, and Lebanon. And there's more. In Britain, anti-war protesters gave Foreign Secretary Jack Straw a rude wake-up call by blaring air sirens outside his London home at 6:30 this morning. Protesters said they briefly blockaded the roads around his home, forcing him to be late to work. Earlier this week, dozens of elderly women blocked the entrance to the RAF Fairford Air Base in Gloucester, England, where U.S. bombers are preparing to be deployed to the Gulf. Some of the women were in wheelchairs. Many were in their 70s and 80s. They held flowers, knitted, sang, danced, and linked arms, bringing military vehicles to a halt. And there's more. The Spanish Civil Guard temporarily seized the famous Greenpeace ship Rainbow Warrior. The ship's captain and two others were arrested. The ship was blocking the joint Spanish-U.S. naval base at Rota in southern Spain, where the U.S. Navy vessel Cape Horn was expected to deliver arms to troops in the Gulf. Activists in Scotland are facing serious charges after dismantling military planes and support equipment intended for use in Iraq. In Germany on Saturday, police carried away hundreds of protesters who were blocking the main gate to the U.S. military's air base. And in Italy, in addition to massive street protests, there have been direct actions at gas stations, airports, and U.S. military bases. We will speak to an indie media reporter in Italy. But first, we're going to begin in Australia.
Good morning, my name is Shane Rattenbury from Greenpeace Australia Pacific. Greenpeace this morning took action here in Canberra, in the capital of Australia. We went to the residence, the official residence of the Prime Minister, John Howard, and placed him under symbolic house arrest for acting in contravention of the United Nations Charter. We did this by taking a number of vehicles up to all the entry points, parking those vehicles across the gates and then locking Greenpeace volunteers onto those vehicles to prevent them being removed. The reason we did this was that we believe that John Howard's action to commit Australia to the war in Iraq is immoral, it's illegal, and it's certainly strongly opposed by the Australian public. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen more than 500,000 Australians turn out for peace rallies across the country. And there's a strong public dissent against Australia being involved in this war. We've seen rallies all around the country. We've seen all sorts of activities. Even yesterday, two very frustrated painters climbed up on the roof of the Opera House and painted "No War" in large red lettering. So we've seen the community reacting in many, many ways. Certainly from a Greenpeace point of view, we've had detailed legal analysis of the case put forward by the United States and United Kingdom governments, which the Australian government has essentially copied. Our analysis of their justifications are that there is no legal case or legal basis for individual UN members to take military action without United Nations approval. The reliance by the United States and Australian governments on United Nations resolutions that were adopted, in 1990 is quite flimsy in our view and is a form of legalistic cherry-picking on behalf of those governments. We think it's a flimsy legal argument and one that won't stand up or doesn't stand up to real scrutiny. We think it's a convenient political argument and that there isn't a legal basis for preemptively attacking Iraq.
Shane Rattenbury, campaign organizer with Greenpeace Australia, among those who surrounded the Prime Minister's house. As we turn now to Turkey, to Banu Dökmecebişi, who is an anti-war organizer. Can you talk about the actions that are taking place there ahead of the second vote by the Turkish parliament on whether the United States can use Turkish airspace to invade Iraq?
Yeah, well, there have been lots of demonstrations and protests and also direct actions for a few months against the possible U.S. attack to Iraq. And there is a No War in Iraq coalition, which is created by more than 150 organizations in Turkey for 3 months. And the coalition is organizing many demonstrations, rallies, and protests all over the country. And today, before the government will present the decision about U.S. troops in Turkey to the assembly, there were some demonstrations all over the country in front of the headquarters of leading party, AK Party. So Greenpeace was there, and we joined the demonstrations. And Friday, there was a direct action of Greenpeace in Turkey, blocking the transportation of U.S. Military equipment in Iskenderun Harbor. So, and at the moment, the government will present to vote the decision of letting U.S. troops and air corridor to the Turkish National Assembly, and they will be voting tomorrow, which all people in Turkey are opposing.
Can you explain to our viewers and listeners why there is a second vote that is taking place and what that has to do with the new Prime Minister Erdogan?
Well, the first voting, which was done on 1st of March, ended up with a rejection to the decision, with more than half of the number of the MPs in the assembly. But then, because of the political changes in the government, the prime minister has been changed, and a new prime minister Erdogan is pushing too much about this decision in the benefit of the country, which he claims, that they will vote it again, and they added to let air corridors to be used for U.S. Army to this decision as well. But the public opposition is increasing, which is already 95% of the people is opposing that decision, and also to the war, of course. And we believe the promise of U.S. credits doesn't legitimize the murder of innocent people in Iraq and all over the world, of course. So we demand the members of Turkish parliament to give the same decision and to stand up in opposition to the war.
I want to move from Turkey to Italy now, where there have been massive demonstrations taking place. We go to Rome to speak with Francesca Bria. What is happening there?
Hi.
So in Italy, there has been like very big demonstration against the war starting from the 15th of February, where there was a huge march in Rome where more than 2.5 million people participated and were in the streets against the war. And then all the movements, that is the movement against the globalization and the Catholic world and a lot of organization, including the union, the worker union, start to build active forms of disobedience and sabotage against the war machine. And the biggest action started that was like a train stopping, so forms of direct action against the war, started the 20th of February when the Italian minister Martino illegally guaranteed the use of the state public infrastructure to allow American army to move weapons, vehicles and personnel in Italy. And this was a moment in which in Italy there were a lot of action diffused all around the Italian territory to block the trains that were bringing the military weapons from the north of Italy to Camp Derby, that is the biggest U.S. military base in Italy. And the train have been effectively blocked for hours. And
how did they block the train?
The activists blocked the train, put in danger their bodies. They went to the rail station, and with hundreds of people blocked the trains during the night also. So there was a huge work of monitoring, you know, when the trains were gonna pass by. So there were a lot of activists and also media activists. I have to say the independent communication work during that day was amazing between indie media and global radio. And activists were exchanging information about the timing when the trains were going to pass, and they were creating spontaneous actions to stop the trains.
Unions, the role of unions if the U.S. invades?
Sorry?
What will the unions do in Italy if the U.S. invades Iraq?
Yeah, the unions announced that there is going to be a general strike in the moment the first bomb will fall on Iraq. There has been the 15th of March, there has been a general strike in Italy for some hours, and there will be a total general strike, so a total block when the war will start. And we hope it's going to be a European general strike. Mm. And I'm talking about the CGIL, CISL, UIL, that are the three main unions in Italy that are going to coordinate the strike in Italy. And the strike will be not only for the working place, not only for the workers, but also for the students, so for the university. And they announced that they are going to occupy the university and block the lessons when the war is going to start, and also for the schools. Yeah.
How many U.S. bases are there in Italy?
How many U.S. bases? There is five NATO military bases, and in total is 16 U.S. military bases, some smaller one, and the biggest one is in Camp Derby in Pisa.
We're gonna turn now to Spain, where we were hoping to be joined by Daniel Rizzotti, who is the captain of the Rainbow Warrior, but he is off trying to get an impounded anchor from the Rainbow Warrior back from the Spanish government. So we're joined by Timo Marshall, who is a spokesperson for the Greenpeace ship. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Can you tell us what happened with the Rainbow Warrior?
Well, we arrived in Cadiz in Spain at the beginning of last week, and very near the port of Cadiz is the naval port of Rota, which is used by American forces as a naval base, and there is also a landing strip there. We proceeded to go and protest in front of this base with the Rainbow Warrior, culminating in the Rainbow Warrior parking at the entrance to the port and blockading the ships inside from leaving. We were targeting particularly a military supply vessel called the Cape Horn, and we managed with that action to stop it from departing from the port.
And were people arrested?
Well, what subsequently happened was that the Guardia Civil, which is the Spanish, one branch of the Spanish police, boarded the ship. At this point, the crew and various other activists that were on board the ship, we locked ourselves inside the vessel, inside the bridge, and locked down all entrances so they couldn't actually get in. This forced them to have to maneuver the ship by themselves using tugs, which they did after they cut our anchor chain, and they brought us into port. Once they arrived in port, they proceeded to smash the windows of the bridge. They came in and were fairly violent with the activists inside. They arrested three people, and two of them ended up in hospital.
We go now to Scott. Go ahead.
Those three people are now, they were released after 24 hours from jail under something they call here provisional freedom, and they still have got to go to trial for those situations, so we won't know the outcome of that for a while.
We're going to go to Scotland in a minute, but we're going to break. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we hear about direct actions around the world, from Australia to Spain to Italy. Next up will be Scotland. And then how is the media in this country covering this period before an invasion of Iraq, if in fact that happens? Because until the moment the invasion takes place, it has not taken place, even if the bombs continue to fall on Iraq. And you can see people are doing things around the world. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
As the sun rose on the rim of the eastern sky, and this one world that we love was trying to die, we said stand and sing out for a great Horatio. Your child may be the one to exclaim,
Emperor is Naked Today, another Pete Seeger song sung by Dave Carter and Tracy Grammer. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we end up our world roundup on direct actions, just a small fraction of them, in Scotland with David McKenzie, organizer with Trident Plowshares. Can you tell us what Trident Plowshares is and what you've done?
Trident Plowshares is a campaign of nonviolent direct action against Britain's nuclear weapons. But in fact, our activists get involved in direct action, obviously, over the war as well. And the most significant one was last week when Ulla Roder, one of our pledgers, was arrested and charged with criminal damage after damaging a Tornado ground attack aircraft in Lucas Air Base. I heard from Ulla yesterday that she's been advised that the damage to the aircraft is £25 million, which means that it won't be flying to Iraq. And when I spoke to Ulla on Saturday, she was really delighted with her work. And obviously, we're really thrilled that she had the courage to do this as well.
Can you explain what was done?
Sorry?
Can you explain exactly what was done?
Lucas Air Base is in Fife in Scotland, and she went in during the night, explored the base, found a hangar, and went in, and there was a Tornado aircraft in the hangar. And she had with her a set of bolt cutters, which she used as a hammer, and she set to and let fly at the nose cone of the aircraft, the cockpit, the fuselage, the wings, the tailplane, and other bits she didn't know the names of, and caused this enormous amount of damage. Then she sat down and symbolically put pieces of bread, as a symbol of we should be working for bread, not bombs, all around the hangar, and then sat down and waited for the security people to come, which they did, and took it away.
In the United States, at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, the military said that they could use deadly force against protesters who go on to the site there. What has been the response in Scotland? And also your action now, that action of this past weekend follows up on another action last week.
That's indeed, yeah. Also last week, Margaret Jones and Paul Milling in RAF Fairford damaged over 30 vehicles, which are used to service and arm the B-52 bombers that are stationed there. So obviously there will be a question about the authorities getting more jumpy. Mind you, we have been involved in direct action against Trident in the UK for a number of years now, for 4 years, and we've always been told that the people defending these horrible engines of war have the right to shoot. We've never actually met that threat directly yet, so at the moment, we don't think it's going to happen, but it could change in the current atmosphere, obviously.
What do you say to President Bush saying he's going into Iraq because Saddam Hussein has brutalized so many Iraqis? The now working name of the invasion is Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I think most people would want that terrible regime to end peacefully. We know that the U.S. approach to this, the U.S. government approach to this, is entirely selective. In a few weeks, we understand that George Bush will be in China, a country with a human rights record on a huge scale, I think particularly of Tibet, and there will be a totally different approach. The double standards are obvious. The real motivations are pretty clear to everybody. And that's why people like Ulla feel that they have to take responsibility as ordinary citizens to back up international law.
Well, David McKenzie, I want to thank you for wrapping up our direct action roundup around the world, speaking to us from Scotland with Trident Plowshares. You are listening to Democracy Now! A new study by the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has found network newscasts are dominated by current and former U.S. officials and largely exclude Americans who are skeptical of or opposed to an invasion of Iraq. Meanwhile, the Conservative Media Research Center has released a study of its own. It accuses ABC Nightly News of championing France and the United Nations over the United States, treating Iraqi propaganda with less skepticism than Bush administration pronouncements, and, quote, sanitizing radical protesters. We're joined by Steve Rendell of FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Can you talk about your report?
Yes, Amy. We looked at 2 weeks of the coverage of ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, NBC Nightly News, and the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. We looked at it for a two-week period beginning a week before Colin Powell's February 5th address to the UN Security Council and going till a week afterwards. We looked at every on-camera source who appeared and was quoted in a story about Iraq. There were 393 of these total sources. This was at a time in which there was fierce debate on what policy towards Iraq should be. Our main findings: overwhelming reliance on official sources. 76% of all official sources, 297 out of 393, were officials, current or former government employees. Now, what's wrong with that? Well, when you have that many official sources, there's very little room left over for independent or grassroots voices. And indeed, that was found to be true. Skeptics. Overall, skeptics who appeared made up just 17% of sources. This was at a time when, in most countries around the world, skepticism or outright opposition to war ran at around 80%. In the United States at that time, according to a CBS poll, 61% of Americans were telling CBS's poll that they wanted more time for inspections and more time for diplomacy. Now, of U.S. sources, U.S. sources made up 68% of all sources, almost 70%. 75% of U.S. sources were current or former officials. In total, out of 267 U.S. sources, one was identified as a peace activist. She was a physician for Physicians for Social Responsibility. This is a tiny...
Out of how many?
Out of 267. It's a tiny fraction of 1%. In the entire list of 393 sources, three sources, less than 1%, identified as voices of peace. Now, the Media Research Center, according to this morning's Times, is claiming that ABC is carrying the water of Saddam Hussein. Or so. ABC had 92 sources in this period. One was a peace activist. That was the physician from Physicians for Social Responsibility. The other two peace activists were both street activists. There was one peace activist shown who was a UK citizen and another who was a German citizen.
What's your point in making a distinction between internationals and people from the U.S.?
Well, because a lot of the internationals, 20 of the so-called skeptics, were members of the Iraqi government. Many more were members of governments that are more or less friendly to the United States but disagree with the United States about this, say officials from the French and German government who would be listed as skeptics. Now, the problem, I should point out what skeptics means. It doesn't mean anti-war voices. It means people who thought that there should be more time given for diplomacy or inspections to work, or who were worried that what the cost of the war might be in terms of, you know, education and domestic priorities and that sort of thing. They were not identified as voices of peace. Overall skeptics, 17%. Overall voices of peace, a fraction of 1%.
You know, it's interesting. I went on Charlie Rose last week. People can check out the transcript at democracynow.org. And when I raised the issue of the corporate media beating the drums for war, he took great issue with this, saying he, too, worked for the networks, works over at CBS, and said that it impugned the character of Peter Jennings or Tom Brokaw or Dan Rather, his colleagues, to say that there was any kind of cheerleading. He said, I promise you that the media doesn't have that kind of bias.
Well, I mean, the proof is on the screen or on the page or coming out of your radio. So it doesn't matter what Charlie Rose says. I mean, look, these numbers, a fraction of 1% were anti-war voices out of these 393. Only 17% were skeptics. This fits into a larger framework. This isn't the only evidence of bias. If you look what happens at these networks and cable news channels, when the question is war, they run out and they hire ex-generals, former Pentagon officials, national security types, people, men and women, to a person who think in terms of military solutions. They're militarists. Do they provide a counterweight? Do they go out and look through the academy and look at authors? Do they look at the people who have spent, in some cases, decades studying international law, human rights, and the conflict resolution traditions of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King? Are those people hired? No, we know they're not. We know that demonstrations are covered very poorly. Maybe slightly better since the absolute debacle of the New York Times and National Public Radio in their coverage of the October 26 demonstrations. Maybe they've covered slightly better. And there are exceptions like Maria Hinojosa at CNN, who has attempted to cover peace activists in their day-to-day work. Generally, the media looks at peace activism as only being a story on the days when there are huge demonstrations and not the day-to-day work.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a piece on the commondreams.org website, Media Giants Rally Sponsorship Raises Questions, by Tim Jones. It was published in the Chicago Tribune. It says, some of the biggest rallies this month have endorsed President Bush's strategy against Saddam Hussein, and the common thread linking most of them is Clear Channel Worldwide, Inc., the nation's largest owner of radio stations. In a move that has raised eyebrows in some legal and journalistic circles, Clear Channel radio stations in Atlanta, Cleveland, San Antonio, Cincinnati, and other cities have sponsored rallies attended by up to 20,000 people. The events have served as a loud rebuttal to the more numerous but generally smaller anti-war rallies. The sponsorship of large rallies by Clear Channel stations is unique among major media companies, which have confined their activities in the war debate to reporting and occasionally commenting on the news. The San Antonio-based broadcaster Clear Channel owns more than 1,200 stations in 50 states in the District of Colombia. It's by far the largest owner of radio stations in the nation. The company owned only 43 in 95. But when Congress removed many of the ownership limits in 96, Clear Channel was quickly on the highway to radio dominance. The company now owning and operating more than 1,200 radio stations, including six in Chicago, and claims 100 million listeners. Clear Channel generated about 20% of the radio industry's $16 billion in 2001 revenues, which brings together the FCC story of deregulation. FCC run by Michael Powell, son of General Colin Powell, with the whole issue of war coverage.
I was on MSNBC recently with a program director from Clear Channel who was one of the organizers of these rallies for America. They're using the biggest radio chain in the country to try to gather rallies that are in favor of President Bush and the soldiers and such. In fact, a lot of them are very pro-war in nature, these rallies. But they are using that, and still they're only able to get, I think they claimed to have 25,000 people come out in Atlanta. I think that was their biggest demonstration so far. I was listening to one of the main organizers, a radio talk show host named Glenn Beck. I think he comes out of Ohio. And Glenn Beck on his show the other night said that he got down on his knees every night and prayed that Dennis Kucinich would burst into flames. This is the crude approach that they use. But I think that this really gets back to something we talked about last time I was on the show. The NBC memo, the secret report where NBC did a review of MSNBC programming. They said that the thing basically was used to fire Phil Donahue. And it said that they were afraid that Phil Donahue presented a difficult face for MSNBC in a time of war, and that they were afraid that his show would be seen as a home for the anti-war movement at a time when our rivals are all waving the flag. Indeed, they are waving the flag. And if you look at especially...
And Phil Donahue was fired.
And he was fired after that. And if you look at across the country, if you look at the opinion-shaping elites, those who have op-ed page columns, George Will and Cal Thomas are the most syndicated columnists in the country. George Will, additionally, is in Newsweek. Those who appear on television and those who host radio talk show hosts, it is very hard to find anybody speaking, even skeptically, let alone in opposition to the war effort.
What can people do, Steve? We just have 30 seconds.
Well, I think I would hope people go to FAIR's website and look at this study and look at a lot of our material, and that's at www.fair.org. And while you're there, sign up for our listserv, because you'll get this sort of stuff, our action alerts and our media advisories, when they come out. And
Does it matter if people call?
Well, we always provide information for the networks. They can. Our website has email and phone and snail mail addresses for all of the main media outlets in the country. Of course, it helps if they call.
Has a peace activist ever been put on the payroll of one of these networks to counter the ex-generals and others on the payroll?
I can't say they haven't, but I can't tell you who it would have been. I haven't seen it, no.
Well, I want to thank
you
very much
for
being with us. Steve Rendell with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And that does it for our show. All contact information for our different guests is on our website at www.democracynow.org. Tell us what you're doing in this time of war. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. If you want a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.